welcome to the program. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
No, thanks for having me.
So you are an assistant professor of space power. Can you tell us a little bit about what that job entails and the professional journey that sort of led you to the position that you're in now?
Sure. What it is actually, I'm a professional military education professor at the Air Force's Air Command and Staff College. I've been doing that for, this is my fifth year now, both in uniform and now as a civilian. What's interesting about this year is that we have a Department of Space Power now, specifically established to teach professional military education to Space Force officers and other people that are connected to this space, the military space program. We have Army students, we've got some foreign students, and predominantly right now we have 26 students. Most of them are U.S. Space Force. And what we do is teach mid-level officers, major lieutenant commanders, a year-long professional military education at about their mid-career point. And that involves teaching war theory is how we start out. Then we get into leadership and then teach space power theory, space power strategy, a little bit of the history, and then joint warfare, mostly aligned with how the Air Force teaches or educates their mid-career officers. So, you know, a couple of years ago, I was working for the Air Force. Now I'm working for the Department of the Air Force doing a Space Force mission. How did I get here? Well, I thought I was going to be a 30-year career Air Force Space Command officer. So I graduated from the Air Force Academy with a degree in space operations, thinking I was going to have a long career in the active duty military, and didn't. They got rid of a lot of our space officers in about 2007. I volunteered out to become a reserve officer, but I wanted to work with the new space industry. About the time I got commissioned is when the Spaceship One launches were, pretty close to where I grew up in Mojave, California. And I wanted to get out and work with the civilian new space community a little bit. Was able to do that. Got to work at Spaceport America in New Mexico. Helped build that facility, which was really neat. Got to launch a few suborbital rockets out of there. But ultimately, I always wanted to be in the military. So I got into sort of the military education aspect, taught space power for a while, then ended up doing going to Air Command and Staff College in residence, then going on to the strategic school afterwards, and then got picked up for ACSC to be an instructor. So I guess on active duty, I did GPS, you know, global positioning system, tactics and engineering for my 4.5 years. In my military life in the reserve, I've taught mostly, but I've also been Air Operations Center officers in Korea and the Middle East, other things like that. So it's a fun time. But if you would have asked me when I was a cadet, what, you know, do I want to teach professional military education? I would say, sure. So, you know, I'm living the dream, really.
So the class and curriculum for space power, is that's fairly new, it sounds like.
It actually started when I was a student there in about 2014. I found out a friend of mine that I had known for a little while in the Air Force got sent to ACSC as a, you know, sort of a farewell retirement assignment. But we were both really interested in space. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Gerritsen, he gets published every now and then, has a new book coming out. He just recently retired. And then I just mentioned him, hey, if you need to do something, why don't you start putting together a space class? And he did. And it's slowly grown into, you know, from an elective to a year-long elective, now to a complete year-long, you know, a competitive education for the U.S. Space Force. So it was a really, you know, it's been around since about 2014 in various incarnations, but now it is very robust. We have, this is our third class. We started our first class in, 2019 now, 2018, academic year 18, We had our second class just graduate a couple of months ago, and now we're about 3 months into our third class. So it's relatively new, but it has a little bit of a pedigree.
So as I understand it, you were also director of the Space Immersion Program. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
That was actually the older version of what is now the Schriever Space Scholars. So I founded the Schriever Scholars when it first stood up as a concentration at the at ACSC 3 years ago, and it was a fun time because the dean basically just told us, "Hey, what would you do if you had space officers for a 10-month long educational program?" And you know, we just started throwing books together and came up with it pretty quick. And it turned out, in my opinion, very well. And it hasn't significantly changed that much in the 3 years that we've taught it. So really, when I say the Space Immersion Program, that was the, you know, it started out as an elective, then went into the Space Immersion Program, then they decided on Schriever Scholars. Now they decided on Schriever Space Scholars. So everything's pretty consistent, but the name.
Okay. So this might seem like an obvious question to someone in your line of work, but I think a lot of Americans would actually be surprised to find out that space technology and space infrastructure are a very important point or a very important part of how the United States military wages war today. That it's not some futuristic dream of how it might impact us in the future, but we're already very dependent on that technology. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, and I think it's... You can think of it as it's just an extension of how much our society is sort of dependent on space now. Everyone uses GPS now in their cell phones, in their car, for any number of different issues. Right now, there's a lot of rain in where I'm at in Alabama because of a hurricane that has made it inland. So now it's just a lot of rain, but not a big deal. But we use weather satellites constantly. So the military is no different. Space is an informational conduit for a lot of things that we need to do to bring forces forward, to take military forces from the United States to the Middle East, to the Pacific. You know, we have imagery satellites to find out where we're going and what's going on around there. GPS lets us not just know where we are, but where we need to go. Navigation, positioning, timing is a huge deal. You know, missile warning is a big deal for our forces that are forward deployed, whether it be in the Middle East or other places. But really, the military is no more dependent on space than the rest of society is. A recent Department of Commerce study says that the United States earns $350 billion a year in economic activity simply from GPS. That's $1 billion a day. So our whole society is really connected in space that people really aren't all that aware of still. Maybe aware intellectually, but maybe not emotionally, which is an interesting thing, because part of being in the space force and being in government space is that we want to make sure that no one has to worry about us, that the lights will always be on. The GPS will always be there. But then at the same time, people start wondering, well, why do you need a space force again? So it's an interesting conundrum, but you know.
So this is more of a vintage space topic, but we had a podcast where we talked a little bit about the Strategic Defense Initiative during the Cold War. And I don't know how much of your course deals with history as opposed to contemporary challenges that the United States military faces. But I couldn't help but wonder if you had any thoughts about whether the Strategic Defense Initiative was perhaps sort of a bluff that the Reagan administration thought that the Soviet Union might be drawn into an extended arms race that they couldn't win and couldn't afford financially, or if, from some sources I've looked at, it seems like President Reagan was committed to the idea that eventually the United States could one day build some sort of a missile shield that would make nuclear weapons obsolete.
You know, I think the answer really is yes to all of the above. It seems pretty clear to me that Reagan was very much against nuclear weapons, and if he could make them obsolete, he would try it. As far as whether SDI would work, well, Robert Heinlein, the author, definitely thought it would work. That's why he was such a big proponent of it. Other people that worked the system really did think it would work as well. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Clementine mission to the moon under the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization mission. It's not exactly a secret, but people aren't, you know, don't know about it quite as much, is that a lot of the parts or a lot of the systems on that satellite were actually tests for, these Strategic Defense Initiative type technologies for something called Brilliant Pebbles, which was not extraordinarily high tech for the time. It was basically just a whole bunch of cheap satellites that had a lot of, you know, for lack of a better term, maybe a small interceptor or shotgun pellets that could intercept missiles. And that worked just fine. It worked very well, as a matter of fact. Did we ever get close to fielding SDI? Not really. A lot of detractors really focused on X-ray lasers and neutral particle beams and a lot of the stuff that maybe Lawrence Livermore National Labs started coming up with. And that was a little bit more science fiction, maybe could have worked, but would have taken a lot of engineering. Brilliant Pebbles, on the other hand, people swear up and down that it could have been deployed in the early 90s for, you know, not all that expensive. My own personal expertise, I have very little. It's mostly just talking to some of the graybeards that are around, that are around. We don't get into that part of history too much in the Schriever Scholars curriculum, unfortunately, because it's a fascinating subject. I hope that helps, but that's to my extent. Oh, wait, one more. Could it have worked? Some people think so, yes, but there's no doubt that other people like Andy Marshall in the Office of Net Assessment in the Department of Defense very much saw it as a cost imposition strategy for the Soviet Union. If SDI would work, and the Soviet Union probably thought SDI would work because we got to the moon, and if Americans get to the moon, they can do anything, they were going to have to race us, you know, side by side for, technological supremacy in space, or build better missiles or more missiles. And that very well could have hastened the demise of the Soviet Union. So just because it might not have worked doesn't mean that it wasn't a viable strategy. But just because people saw that it might be a cost imposition strategy doesn't mean that no one thought it would work either. So SDI is definitely something that's worth looking at again from a historical perspective, as much as maybe a strategic perspective.
Yeah, I think that's almost a myth that sort of developed when SDI was proposed, as well as time has gone on, that it was this outrageous idea that was science fiction and never could have worked. And getting even beyond that question, the Soviet Union certainly seemed, according to my research, seemed concerned that it was going to be real in the near future, or that it was going to be developed and it could work. So I've read a few articles recently about hypersonic missiles, and I understand Russia just tested a hypersonic missile, according to an article that I read. And I'm wondering, for people who don't know what hypersonic missiles are, could you shed some light on what they are and why this technology might be important in the future, and why the United States might be sort of behind the curve in developing some of this technology in comparison to China or Russia?
That's a good question. And again, that's not really my expertise, but I'll give my best position on it.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, hypersonic missiles are essentially extraordinarily fast cruise type missiles, Mach 3 plus, probably a good deal faster than that. The problem that they present to the United States are, a couple of different ways. Russians, if they have it, they're probably going to threaten with maybe tactical nuclear warheads, which would be very difficult to defend against, very difficult to see coming, and could damage NATO ground forces quite a bit. In the South China Sea, I think there's more of a threat of them actually being used because as near as people know, they're being, they only have conventional warheads, but they're aimed primarily at American naval ships. Now, the problem with the hypersonic missiles is not that they can't be shot down, because our missile defense systems on our Navy ships really can engage them if they know they're coming. The problem is a lot of the radars that tip SeaWiz or something like that are over the horizon. And if you're looking for these things over the horizon, they're going to come in too fast. They're not, you're not going to be able to see them, fix them, and target them before they hit you. So that's a real serious problem for the Navy. Now, why is it that Russia and China might be ahead of the United States? Well, it's really probably comes down to that the United States really doesn't need them. We don't have the same strategic problems that China and Russia do. Our big problem is that we have to defeat hypersonic missiles, or at least mitigate their destructive power, or their strategic threat. If we had our own, you know, I would wager we'd probably target the adversaries, hypersonic missiles. So, is it a huge deal? Now, I come from the space perspective, and my own personal gut feeling is that I don't think hypersonic missiles, at least the first generation that people are thinking about, are really all that important for the space race. Over time, if you have a good hypersonic rocket, you can probably develop a fairly decent launch vehicle. Beyond that, I don't pay much attention. The way that you could probably defeat the forward or the beyond line of sight problem with Chinese rockets or the hypersonic missiles probably have some sort of space solution where you can see the satellites, see them quickly, let our ships know, and then they're ready when they're coming in. But beyond that, It's just another new weapon that we have to deal with. It happens all the time.
That sounds logical enough. So you've mentioned the term Space Force a lot, and so I want to delve into that for our audience members who might have not been following it, or just kind of been following it on the periphery, sort of the news cycle. Over a year ago, maybe more, it was something that people were talking about. And I think there are some misconceptions regarding Space Force. It was kind of the butt of a lot of jokes when the current presidential administration announced it. And there is, I guess, a Netflix show called Space Force that's a comedic program. But it's not an outrageous idea, and it's really not even a new idea. We did a podcast over a year ago where we talked about the Bush administration, as I understand it, had some interest in having a branch of the armed forces or a component of the armed forces that would do space-related tasks, and that was something they were looking into seriously prior to 9/11.
Yeah, the idea of an independent space force has been around for quite some time. Doing some research on it, the farthest back that I can see the conception of a type of space force was actually in the mid-1800s in science fiction. But as a serious issue here in the United States, I think it was probably 1946 when Captain Caleb Lanning of the U.S. Navy and Lieutenant Robert Heinlein, retired medically, talked about what space forces might look like just in the near future using manned sort of extrapolations of V2s. Fascinating article. But the modern version of the Space Force really comes to play about the early 1980s, mid-1980s, with the Strategic Defense Initiative, because that's when the United States Air Force stood up Space Command, which would later become Air Force Space Command. And the United States established the United States Space Command in the mid-80s. And the first thing that the Air Force said about it was the general officer, a pilot in charge, a general named Robert Harris, said, well, everyone thinks that we're going to have this separate space force, but that's not how we fight anymore. So U.S. Space Command will actually be the one that fights in space. And the services just do organized, train, and equip. And the Air Force organizes, trains, and equips space forces. So you're just going to have to forget about the Space Force. Well, you know, God, it almost took 40 years. But now the Space Force is a reality. And it first started the sort of the modern push, you're right, in the Bush administration with the Rumsfeld Commission that gave its report in 2001. I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy at that time. It pretty much said that we were on the way to a Space Force designed Air Force Space Command and put space separately in the Air Force under the United States Air Force, specifically for that purpose, that sooner or later it would evolve into its own independent service. But then you're absolutely right. 9/11 happened and everyone forgot about space for the better part of two decades, or focused on integration of space, not the development of space as a domain, you know, economically, militarily, diplomatically. But did it come out of nowhere with President Trump? Not really, because the people that really did start the Air Force Space Corps, this was in 2017, that drive, was a congressman, Mike Rogers, here in Alabama, and Jim Cooper in Tennessee. One was a Republican, one's a Democrat. And they got very far, and the Department of the Air Force tried to stop them, and did. The Senate blocked it. Those of us that were sort of in, supporters of the Space Force thought, well, you know, it was close. We tried. We got a lot of good stuff. We'll start consolidating. And that's when President Trump said, you know, maybe this Space Force thing is the right idea. So the problem is, though, why is it the butt of jokes and everything else? It's like, well, because the Air Force, as soon as the president started saying Space Force, told everyone in the Department of the Air Force to shut up about it and would not let anyone talk about it. We call it the gag order. Whereas, you know, people in my division, the Schriever Space Scholars knew about this. We wanted to get out to the public, say, hey, these are the pros, these are the cons, this is why they're thinking the way they are.
Why didn't the United States Air Force want people to talk about it?
Oh, because the Air Force wasn't interested in having, you know, its space people taken away from it. It was a decision in the office of the Department of the Air Force, where it's just like, no, we're going to resist this. That's just the way it was. So we had a lot of phone calls, about people wanting to interview professors that knew what they were talking about, to get sort of the serious skinny about this kind of stuff. And our public affairs office just said, you know, nothing. And being the good Americans, we did, you know, nothing. And then saw it become a partisan political issue where people just started ridiculing the president by it. And it was unfortunate because it does seem like it still has this. Well, what are we doing with the Space Force still today? And then it was revealed that there was a gag order, and there's still a lot of animosity in the Department of the Air Force on both sides over that particular one. So that's just the way it goes.
Are you familiar with a book called Project Orion by author George Dyson?
Oh yeah. I've met George. He's a great guy.
Oh, wow. So I was amused by a anecdote in his book. I don't know if it was apocryphal or not, but about the late 1950s, where the different branches of the military were having arguments that went something along the lines of, you know, the Air Force said, well, if it flies in space, then it has to be under the domain of the Air Force. And the Navy said, they're called spaceships for a reason. And the United States Army said, well, the high ground, the ultimate high ground will naturally be the moon, and so on and so forth.
Oh yeah. That to a large extent, that's still happening. I think Project Orion is fascinating personally. And, I got to meet, George because I started looking at the, at Project Orion from a military history perspective. And I've got a lot of research, and a portion of it is actually going to be out in a new book come February, that the Naval Institute Press is releasing on a biography of General Thomas Power, the 3rd Strategic Air Command commander, who was the one that really bit hard on the Orion concept.
So he believed that it would transform world history, didn't it?
He did. He did. He's an unsung space hero in the Air Force. Maybe my biography of him will help that, but who knows? He should be remembered. Mostly he's just remembered as a guy that never graduated from college and was even more evil than Curtis LeMay, which is wrong, but he was probably sort of irascible. But to back to your question, when the Space Corps started coming out in 2017, there was a Navy officer said, don't give space to the Air Force. Space obviously should be the Navy. And I wrote back saying, hey, I believe you that the Navy and maritime history should influence the Space Force. But we've got plenty of naval-centric thinkers here in the Air Force. We'll do just fine. Thank you very much. And, since then, we've actually gotten pretty friendly with each other. But if you're aware, there is a minor debate going on about whether the Space Force should have Navy-style ranks, especially in their officer corps. And that is partially about it, but it's also, even though space grew up in the Air Force, the Space Force emerged from the Air Force, we really do have to think like a Navy to understand completely the space domain and most correctly. So, there's still, even though all the Space Force people right now were ex-Air Force, the Space Force is still trying to get in Navy officers and Army, Marines. It just hasn't happened yet. So, new services don't happen often. So we have a lot of interesting things going on.
Is your opinion that the Space Force should be and will be in the future its own branch?
It is its own branch now, in that it's separate from the United States Air Force, the uniformed military. It is still in the Department of the Air Force, mostly because of political convenience. It's very difficult to justify an entirely new department. In my opinion, do we need a Department of the Space Force? Yes. Why? Because airmen in the Air Force, the Department of the Air Force, and space people cannot think alike. Because if we do, we're going to bring in the Space Force a lot of the airmen's psychological and strategic baggage with us that will make us do the wrong things. That doesn't mean they're bad. That doesn't mean the Department of the Air Force is somehow, not worthy. It's just that you have to have a department that will champion its service. And I don't think any military department could really handle, two services with very, very different strategic cultures, different strategic rationales, and different focuses. I mean, even in the Department of the Navy, where you have the Navy and the Marine Corps, at least they share a lot of history. And the Marines really do work in the maritime domain. That's just what they do. Space forces do not work in the air domain, and nor does the air forces work in the space domain. So yes, I ultimately believe that there needs to be a separation.
And that logic, I think, is pretty hard to argue with. So you wrote a piece, I believe it was for the publication The Hill, where you mentioned monolithic joint culture in different branches of the United States military, or just monoculture. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and why that is very important in the discussion about Space Force?
Sure. It's an extension of what we were just talking about. Defense unification, developing essentially the Department of Defense after World War II, was a big deal. And it was intended by civilians that, in my opinion, probably didn't know any better, to decrease, inter-service rivalry, to decrease bureaucratic overlap, and to force everyone to play along. The problem is that it didn't. It exacerbated the problem because defense unification was developed. The idea was developed by airmen that wanted an independent Air Force because they felt if they could have a unified Department of Defense with an Air Force, an Army, and a Navy, the Air Force could rip off more of the Army and the Navy's budget, which sort of happened a little bit. So in my opinion, it was very disingenuous, the entire argument. Why? Because the Army people thought military and Navy people thought maritime. And there was a great book by an admiral named J.C. Wiley that was written in the mid-50s where he explained, hey, this is why an airman thinks the way he does. This is why a soldier thinks the way he does. This is why a sailor thinks the way he does. And there was a quote in there saying, and, you know, woe to the United States if they all start thinking alike. And it turns out in the 80s and 90s, and especially nowadays, especially after the Goldwater-Nichols Act, you don't get to think Army or Navy or Air Force. You have to think joint. And in order, you have to have a monoculture all around joint behavior. And that's the monoculture. There's no more thinking about deep thoughts about land power or sea power or air power. You have to think about all of them together. And it's really, in my opinion, sank strategic thinking in the United States armed forces. But at least the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy had strategic histories to fall back on. Space does not. So, you know, space is supposed to be different. In my opinion, it's supposed to be based almost entirely off the maritime strategic traditions. Not tactical traditions. There's no salt water in space that we're aware of. Well, depending on where you want to go, depending on the planets and moons, but
not a lot of it in low Earth orbit.
Yeah, probably not. So it's not about tactics. It's about strategy, about being in a place where it's mostly about trade routes. It's mostly about information and economic gain. It's where you can go to new places that you weren't able to go to before with just air, land, or sea power. But if you take a look at the Space Force right now, there's not a lot of independent thinking going on in the uniformed leadership or the at the department level, the Department of the Air Force level. It's all about being on, you know, the joint team. We're supporting the warfighter, and the warfighter being the Army, Navy, Marines, and airmen that are in harm's way. And it stifles strategic thought and stifles strategic debate because the Navy's not really all that keen on, traditional Navy sort of behavior of economic strangulation strategies, keeping open the lines of commerce. They talk a lot about it, but they haven't really had to deal with it for a long time. Because everyone thinks like Army people, because that's what joint is. And if we allow the Space Force to consider itself nothing but another member of the joint service, they will not think beyond, supporting, terrestrial operations in the desert, on the oceans. They won't build spacecraft that can get to the moon. They'll build spacecraft that will provide half a centimeter better resolution for tactical warfighters doing tactical stuff, when, in my opinion, a lot of the problems that we have in the United States demand strategic solutions that don't involve boots on the ground. But if you don't have people that are thinking like airmen and sailors and Army folks and Space Force folks, you're never going to have that broad view of what strategies are open and the art of the possible. Because right now, especially in the Space Force as it is, you're not getting a whole lot of different strategic thinking.
So retired Lieutenant General Stephen Quast seems to be one of, if not the central figure in the discussion about Space Force this past year or two. And I'm wondering why that is.
Well, quite frankly, it's because he's the senior most officer that will talk openly. you know, did he ever have, you know, he was, well, there's a reason he's retired, and it has nothing to do with he wanted to spend more time with his family. But, you know, what did he do? He was a fighter pilot most of his career. He was always sort of an intellectual bent. And he was president of Air University for his first three-star assignment, which is where I work, and got a lot of interested and interesting space people together to talk about the future of space. And he came up with some, quite honestly, brilliant ideas that more than a few people share in the Space Force, but they are not of extraordinarily high rank. So he has, you know, he had very little space responsibilities in the Air Force. He was mostly an outsider and was treated as such. But he would go out and he had a vision. He would talk about it. He would speak about it. He would write. You know, but like everyone else, he sort of shut up during the gag order too, as a good American. But, now that he's retired, he's been speaking, a little bit too. His heritage, speech was particularly good, I thought. But the fact of the matter is, he is a senior Air Force leader that will talk about space, and there are not that many out there. You know, what big policy speeches have you heard from members of the U.S. Space Force?
So is that because of this gag order that you were talking about that has largely silenced a lot of people in that community who might have ideas to contribute?
No, not anymore. The gag order straight up does not exist anymore. Of that, I am very certain. I'm talking to you, but that just goes to show you that, there is a culture of wariness about talking about some of these things, about not getting in front of, or seeming to get in front of your boss, in the senior, levels of the Department of the Air Force, quite frankly. Does it stifle debate? I don't think externally, or it doesn't stifle debates specifically in that if you talk, you're going to be, you know, destroyed. I don't think that's happening. But in the back of your mind, you know, there are a whole bunch of people that were told, hey, you don't talk. You can't talk.
Sort of a culture of silence.
You know, it's not quite like the mafia. But it's,
I meant no disrespect.
Openness is key. I think people think that if it's, it would be too dangerous for their careers to actually get out and speak out.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, speak out, not really like denouncing anybody, just talking about different ideas. You know, it's just very difficult when you have this sort of culture. You know, hopefully we're going to have the culture will open up a little bit more. That has not happened yet. But that might be more just because people are sort of gun shy and timid now, not because there's anyone saying, you know, threatening them with an iron fist, because that is absolutely not happening.
So it seems as though the Pentagon's view for Space Force is this very sort of modest idea that the Space Force will protect the assets that we currently have in low Earth orbit, like satellites or even GPS satellites, which are in much higher than low Earth orbit. Whereas Lieutenant General Quast had this much more expansive, much broader and bolder view for Space Force. And from some of the pieces that you've written, I think you're inclined to agree with his vision. Is that correct?
Well, you know, General Quast's vision is a unique approach, certainly, but his vision is really just the larger space enthusiast's vision. I think he packaged it very, very well, but he didn't say things that were much different from, you know, some of the people that are big in the space development community. Wernher von Braun, you know, a guy named someone that really needs to be known more about. Lieutenant General Danny Graham in the 90s. He has unfortunately passed away. Brigadier General Pete Warden was an Air Force Space Command general officer. Gerard O'Neill, other people, John Lewis, who's big on planetary resources. It's the people that know space, that love space, that breathe space, say pretty much the same thing. And General Quast just seems to be really good at explaining it. But to get back to the Pentagon, well, this is again the monoculture that I was discussing about. If the joint culture is the lowest common denominator between the airmen, sailors, Marines, and Army, well, space is only GPS satellites or, communication satellites or remote sensing satellites. That's it, because that's all they deal with. It's a tactical mindset. The only thing that matters is the fight. The only thing that matters is the, boots on the ground, maybe not the strategy behind why people are doing and what they're doing. But General Quast is a very strategic culture. We have to shift the focus of the nation to space, because that's where we can solve most of our strategic, economic, and social problems. It's a way that military people who are intensely conservative, not necessarily in the modern political understanding of, Democrats versus Republicans, that's not it, but inherently skeptical of radical change. And someone saying, hey, look, the South China Sea is important, or the Middle East is important, but if you're really going to make the United States a superpower for the 21st and 22nd century, you have to go to the moon. That is completely beyond the understanding of a great majority of people, especially in the Pentagon. His view is more expansive because he's a grand strategy kind of guy, General Quast is. You don't get that in uniform very often. And unfortunately, when you do get visionaries in uniform, they tend to, get invited to leave, like General Quast did.
So it does seem that his view is more or less that the United States needs to take a bolder, more leading role in outer space and to have a more expansive vision, because whether we want to or not, that's certainly China's vision for outer space in the coming century, is much larger and more expansive than the United States, at least at the moment, perhaps.
Well, there's very little doubt that China is moving fast in space. A lot of people would argue that China is not doing anything in space that the United States isn't doing. They're mostly focused on, a prestige program, getting to the moon, having a space station, getting astronauts. And it's possible, but it's very difficult, or it's at least a little bit more difficult, marginally more difficult, to land a rover on the south pole of the moon using a repeater at L2, a communication satellite for the far side, than it is just launching, a rover to wherever you want to go on sort of the, closer to the lunar equator. It would appear that that China is doing things more strategically. And then you've got people like Dr. Namada Goswami, who studies China very deeply, saying, look, trust the Chinese when they say things. And what they've been saying in space are gigantic projects like space-based solar power, like, mining the moon in asteroids. And she will go farther to say, hey, look, everyone's aerospace programs shift to the right. It's always harder than people think. But whereas United States aerospace programs might shift a decade, if we're lucky, the Chinese actually do what they say they're going to do in space by within about 18 months. we have to, from a military, from a grand strategy standpoint, we should take China at their word. And the military, the DOD, likes to talk about asymmetric strategies and asymmetric threats and, asymmetric advantages. Well, the United States' asymmetric advantage is undoubtedly space, because we're better than anyone else on the planet by far. Now, we're not doing quite as well as China because China is actually motivated. The United States is not as motivated. Elon Musk is. Jeff Bezos is. Certain people in the government would like us to become more motivated. But really, the potential that the American people have in space is untapped. You go to Marshall Space Flight Center, which is about 3 hours north of here, and you'll get in some really interesting conversations with a lot of great propulsion engineers. It's important, for great power competition's sake, to really take this more seriously than maybe the United States has. Now, the adoption and establishment of the Space Force is a huge step, but now we have to focus on what the Space Force does and how the Space Force looks at its mission. Is its mission supposed to be supporting the warfighter in a tactical joint mindset? Well, that's what most of the senior leadership team, you know, tends to think. That's what the Pentagon talks about. Space is a warfighting domain. Well, what did General Quast and some of the people that he that share his vision say? Space is a competitive domain. The great power of the 21st and 22nd century will be decided in space. That's something that you will not hear from the Pentagon, that you should hear from the Space Force and the United States Space Command, in my opinion.
You've mentioned a term coined by a political scientist, and I hope I'm saying this correctly. It's called Thucydides trap, as sort
Thucydides
of
trap.
Thucydides trap. Excuse me.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about that in the context of the United States and China and in the 21st century?
Sure. Well, the Thucydides trap was named. I don't know who coined it. It's been around for a while, if I remember correctly. But basically, Thucydides was the writer of the history of the Peloponnesian War, between Athens and Sparta, you know, thousands of years ago in Greece. And the Peloponnesian War was started, according to Thucydides, because Sparta was the superpower of Greece. But Athens found a lot of money over the sea and became a sea power and started to become a great power in and of itself and started to threaten Spartan's dominant position. And the Thucydides trap was, Thucydides said the war was inevitable because of the fear of the rise of Athens in Sparta. So Sparta was going to declare war on it inevitably before Athens became too powerful to stop in a war. So the rise of the power of Athens and the fear that it instilled in Sparta caused the war. The Thucydides trap is a generalization of that kind of idea. Right now, China and the United States. The United States is this superpower right now. Certainly more so maybe 10 years ago, but it's still a superpower. China is the rising competitor. The Thucydides trap, and Alison Graham wrote a book about this, is the threat that China's rising so fast, it, sooner or later, the United States is going to fight China in order to prevent China from eclipsing the power of the United States. That's why people think about it. Now, how does that approach to space? Well, if you think about it logically, the way that you prevent a Thucydides trap or a war because of Thucydides trap is never to allow that rising power to get close to you. That would say to me not to, you know, browbeat China or, you know, get ready to fight it or anything else. That would mean growing economically faster than China so you leave China in the dust. How does that translate to space? Well, space is going to be the economic growth engine of the 21st and 22nd century, in my opinion. Who goes to space first and who goes to space best for economic gain is going to be the economic superpower of the late 21st and 22nd centuries. That's why I think General Quast would probably agree that the Space Force needs to be a generator of, you know, economic power. It needs to protect American society going into space to mine the moon, mine the asteroids, develop space-based solar power, and protect those streams of wealth that will allow the American economy to grow to, you know, far faster than it's growing now and eclipsing China's economic growth rate. If the best way to get out of the Thucydides trap is to never allow Athens to get bigger than you in the first place. So that's really where I came from when I used that in that article that you were referring to. Economic growth through space is going to be the driver of great power competition in the future. And the you know, if the United States has abundant cheap power from space and abundant mineral resources from the asteroids and the moon, you know, Chinese aggression in the South China Sea will not be as dangerous as people tend to think it is, for either the United States or for American allies that may feel threatened. Space is not a warfighting domain where we have to focus on beating China. We have to focus on outcompeting China. And there is a military component to that, although maybe not a warfighting one, if we play our cards right.
I suppose the analogy that would be appropriate is you can have two world powers that have great navies without those navies necessarily going to war. And those that could play a vital role in terms of one nation having supremacy over the other or one nation's economy prospering over the other. But it doesn't necessarily imply that there's a naval war or conventional war of any kind actively taking place.
Well, I mean, that's the idea, you know, hopefully, right? That, you know, that is China going to continue to rise as an economic power? More than likely. Is there, you know, is there room for in the world and in the solar system for a rich China? Of course there is. You know, it would probably be better for everybody if we figured out how to coexist and, you know, work together and, you know, work towards that, you know, future that we all hope that we can find in space as sort of a, you know, one big happy sort of, you know, human family, right? But the way we do that is through, you know, rapid economic growth, bringing up everybody in the world as much as we can to, you know, advanced, you know, lifestyles, you know, the quality of life improvements from around the world, decreasing our ability or decreasing the ecological damage that we as a society place on Earth. And there's a lot of things that can happen in space to help that. That's what animates Jeff Bezos, for instance. You know, Elon Musk wants to send a whole bunch of people to Mars. You know, good luck. God bless. If I didn't have four kids, I'd probably try to join. But, you know, space can solve a lot of problems that everyone has, that all nations have. And it would be better to work together. Unfortunately, or it's not unfortunate, I think it's just the way it goes, that it's cooperation that we have in space will more than likely need to be done on an individual nation, case by case basis. I have no problem, you know, with the Chinese Space Force serving alongside a U.S. Space Force, satellite or vehicle or any number of different things, to help keep the moon safe. I don't have a problem with that.
So, I think Lieutenant General Quast makes some very compelling points, and I can only hope that a lot of the advancements that he is predicting in on the landscape of space, you know, sort of the opening vistas of space is how John F. Kennedy referred to them. I can only hope that that's the reality that comes to pass in the next 10 to 20 years. But just to play devil's advocate, in 1969, when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, Wernher von Braun pitched the idea of a mission to Mars to Congress that would have landed on Mars sometime in the mid to late 1980s. And then, you know, we know that didn't come to pass. And then George H.W. Bush had his famous Space Exploration Initiative in 1989 that talked about building bases on the moon, returning the United States to the moon, having this massive space station in low Earth orbit, far larger than the International Space Station, and eventually returning astronauts to Mars. But Congress didn't like the price tag of that. So, you know, in playing devil's advocate, I just have to ask, do you think that it's possible that history might repeat itself in the sense that some of these grandiloquent adventures in space that we've been promised in the past or that have been predicted might not come to pass as quickly as some people might be predicting?
That is always a possibility. I would caution, though, that you have to worry a little bit about the self-fulfilling prophecy aspect of this question, in that why did we not go to Mars after the Apollo moon landings? Was it technical? No. I'm fairly certain Von Braun would have gotten us there.
I agree, absolutely.
You know, but what was the problem? Well, NASA did not have the mandate to go to Mars. The price tag was very high, you know, but really the, you know, American people wanted to do other things, or at least the U.S. government wanted to do other things. So, you know, other people talk about this problem with, well, we never got, you know, O'Neill colonies or lunar, you know, colonization or settlement. And the real no joke reason is that, well, NASA was never told to do that. NASA only got funded for a space shuttle, only got funded for the space station, and then had to sell half of it to the Russians to get it across the finish line. So if government people that are in charge of NASA, that are in charge of the Space Force, that are at the lead of the National Space Council, don't believe that this future is going to happen, they will find ways to make sure it doesn't happen, right? You know, we have a forcing function that we didn't have before in, you know, the Chinese having a very robust economy, that are very interested in space. So we have an external pressure in China that we may, you know, we might not have had before. But we also have commercial people. You know, I'm almost certain that NASA will not be the first boot on Mars. You know, maybe it'll be, but SpaceX is surely given a, you know, given them a run for their money. They're building the Starship right now.
Absolutely.
You know, so there's a couple of forcing functions, but ultimately, could all this stuff blow up? Could Bezos get tired and go home? Yes. Could something happen to Musk where he's just not there to push his company anymore? Well, maybe. So it is possible, but I think in order to make sure that doesn't happen, the government has to retool NASA and really retool the Space Force into being a more of a naval kind of service that that reaches out to make sure that commerce can do what they want to do, that ensures that you know, resources flow from space to the American economy, that we don't get into Musk's way, you know, when he decides to send his folks to Mars, if he ever gets that far. You know, instead of saying, well, I don't know if this is the right idea, or, well, we'll do something when we have to, you know, this is what this, you know, some Space Force people say, hey, we'll deal with this problem when it becomes a problem. Well, they think of it as a problem rather than an opportunity. What they should be doing is like, hey, Musk, this is great. You're really pushing the American flag as far as you can go in space. How can we help? That really doesn't happen. We had a general officer at the Space and Missile Systems Center a couple of months ago claim that the Space Force doesn't seem to have a requirement for heavy lift like the like the Starship would offer. For space enthusiasts, that sounds insane. Of, you know, all of the problems in space go away if Starship works, and Americans have a ton of them. But if you have general officers saying that, you know, he's probably the same one saying, oh, don't worry about anything. There's not going to be any new change in space. You know, don't worry about anything new because that would hurt my brain and I would have to adjust some preconceived notions. It's not really the attitude that Americans should want their government to have, because if people remain like that in government leadership positions, they will ensure that the space future that the optimists want don't come to pass. That's just the way it is. In my opinion, the Space Force should be throwing money at Musk to build Starship, because that's the DC-3 of space, or the Liberty ship of space, depending on how you think about it. So, you know, it's always healthy to be a little skeptical. But I would say that the dangers of being pessimistic far outweigh the dangers of being optimistic. So if we're optimistic, say, for the Space Force, and we're like, no, we're going to focus on satellites, we're going to focus on satellite warfare, because that's what we know, that's what we understand, and then Musk's Starship really does work, and he gets to, you know, the moon or Mars, and, you know, all of a sudden, they need the Space Force out there for protection, and the Space Force can't figure out what to do with itself and is behind the times, or doesn't support American companies enough, and China comes over and takes all that. That's extraordinarily bad. That's the worst case scenario if we stay pessimist. They might be right 99 times out of 100, probably more like 47 times out of 100. But if they're wrong, the consequences are catastrophic. The United States is no longer a great power. Now let's say we do the optimistic thing and we build the Space Force specifically to be able to handle, hey, we're going to be partners step by step. We'll lead the way. We will extend the global positioning system out into cislunar space. We will ensure that we have astronaut rescue capability as soon as a Starship is ready to go to the moon. And then nothing happens. Well, as long as the Space Force was still making sure GPS worked, was still making sure that the government, the information flow was going well for the rest of the military, we're, you know, okay. You know, we might have spent a lot of money and it might not have bought much as far as capabilities, but what did you do? You educated a whole new generation of enthusiastic engineers and scientists that wanted to conquer the universe, that wanted to conquer the solar system, just like Apollo did. And when space didn't really pan out, well, what did they do? Well, we'll do the internet. We'll do, you know, semiconductors. We'll do all this other kind of stuff.
Those talents and those skill sets are transferable.
The engineering and science skill sets in mathematics especially are universally transferable.
In your opinion, what is the greatest value that the Earth's moon has? Is it more economic than military for the United States perspective?
Yes. Now, I am not going to lie. I'm going to tell you right now that I have been very, very, inspired by naval writings and naval theory. I believe Mahan entirely when he says that that sea power is inherently economic. I think space power is inherently economic as well. The value of GPS is not in dropping bombs accurately. It's in making $350 billion of extra economic activity per year in the United States. The moon is going to be the same way. It just so happens to be the gas station of the solar system. On the poles, around the poles, you have abundant sunlight, relatively abundant sunlight, and relatively abundant water. And electricity can crack water into the two best chemical, propellants in, you know, that we're aware of. Very easy to deal with, hydrogen and oxygen. Who was it that said, Robert Heinlein again said, if you're halfway, you know, if you make it to low Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere in the solar system. All you have to do is top off the tank somewhere around, you know, low Earth orbit or around lunar orbit or somewhere else where you can get a lot of this lunar propellant, hopefully fairly cheaply, especially if, the government helps subsidize it. And subsidy is not a bad word if you're talking about economic development. You can get anywhere in the solar system and anywhere in the solar system cheaply. And anywhere in the solar system cheaply opens up a lot of business cases that people have wanted to crack for ages, but just can't. That's when the military interest comes to play. And the military interest isn't to conquer the world. It's not to be, you know, maniacal or anything else. It's to make sure that the resources flow that Earth needs from all this economic activity in space and defends it from, pirates. And right now, what is jamming a satellite other than electromagnetic piracy? Resources, electricity, platinum group metals, you name it. All that activity is going to be very important on Earth. And it's important for the military to protect that, not to conquer other people with it. In my opinion, a militarized space, provided it's done correctly, is actually a very positive, happy future. I'm still a reserve officer. I wanted to join the military when I was young, and I don't think I'm a warmongering, crazy person. I'm a space crazy person. There's a huge difference.
I would agree.
It's how you develop new frontiers is you need the, you need the pioneer, you need the businessman, you need the engineer, you need the farmer, and you need the cavalry. Or the frigate, depending on how you look at it. And I think, the Space Force can really do an awful lot with that. And I'm very enthusiastic about the NASA Space Force Memorandum of Understanding they put out just a couple of weeks ago, because it's a very good first step to produce a unified government approach to space that is very much towards a positive future, where space isn't just a war-fighting domain, it is a domain of human flourishing. And I would rather spend military money on that than a space weapon.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to clarify, I thought you made an interesting point that at least in the near term, people have talked about in regards to the moon mining helium-3, and that could be used in nuclear fusion reactors here on Earth when nuclear fusion is developed in the future. And there are a lot of different economic data points that we could talk about in regards to the moon. But it seems like one of the points that you're making is that in the near future, water, or by extension, the propellant made from that water, will be the most important resource. Again, in the near term, going along with your analogy of the moon as a gas station.
That's what I would argue right now. I think most people would probably argue that as well.
And Mars could be looked at similarly in some respects, thinking, extrapolating further out into the future, decades from now, because it also has water that could be used as propellant.
Sure. And methane in its atmosphere and other things like that. It's hard to know what exactly is going to be, the big economic boom that might happen in space. If you think about the Western expansion, especially of Europe into the New World, it was, the chief exports from, the colonies were, gold and silver. Then it turned out to be, as people started to develop more, it was tobacco and cotton. And then, New England timber for ships. And ultimately, this weird thing called coal and then oil. There's certain things that most people think are commodities or don't think much, about, economically, coal for a long time just used to be something that people hated until they found out that you can actually use it to power the Industrial Revolution. Oil was equally something like, oh God, if you've got oil on your property, that's not going to grow anything. You might as well get rid of it. And then we made some billionaires out of that. is helium-3 going to be a big deal? I don't know. It might. It, there's, it, you know, especially if they can get fusion off of it, then, you know, as soon as the engineers figure out how to do it well, then it's up to the businessmen to try to figure out how to make it profitable. But then there might be something totally different up there that we have no idea is, you know, useful or great. And, you know, be prepared to be surprised, because that's how economics goes.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise with us. And I think this interview for our audience can connect a lot of the different points that we've been talking about, both historically in the space race and the Cold War, and looking towards the future of human space exploration as well.
Well, great. I'm again, thank you for inviting me, and I'm hoping it was a good couple of minutes well spent by you and your listeners.